Anna here. Now, are you an entrepreneur who wants to write and publish a book about your own failures turned successes? Well, good news, that's what my company, Legacy Launchpad, does. Find out more at LegacyLaunchpadPub.com. That's LegacyLaunchpadPub.com. Now, should you do a book, you ask? I think so. Why? Because you're worth it. Now back to the show. Now, the best books are made up of stories. And let's face it, the best stories are about bouncing back from failure. I'm Anna David, obsessed with books, a New York Times bestselling author, and the CEO of Legacy Launchpad Publishing. And I only achieve those things because I picked myself up again after failing and found my way to success. And that makes me uniquely qualified to get the best stories about failure and success out of other people.
Failure is always a learning experience.
So after 6 months, I told him that I Googled sociopath and he had all of the symptoms and I found myself out of job.
At that time, it was supposed to be a side hustle.
Well, the side hustle started to make far more money than the real hustle. So after six months, I quit my job.
Welcome to Fail Your Way to Success.
Hello and welcome to the podcast that believes that success can come in the least likely of places, including prison. Yes, my guest today, the amazing reinvention architect Craig Stanland, was in prison for committing fraud, and guess what? He doesn't consider that his greatest failure. You got to listen to find out what was. And he also shares at the end his top three tips for bouncing back from failure. And you got to hear him because they're incredibly original. And he basically tells you exactly what to do when you fail to go into this process. Craig works with usually middle-aged men who are looking for fulfillment. He works as a coach, but he also has a 23-year-old female client. He's the best-selling author of the book Blank Canvas. He speaks all over the world. He has an amazing TED Talk. And now I give you Craig Stanland. Well, let us launch into, I know your biggest failure, at least I think I know. So, but why don't you tell my listeners what you perceive to be your biggest failure?
So I'm going to take a guess that you think my biggest failure is going to federal prison and losing everything. I think that would be, that's really obvious. That's a big one. I would actually think, and I thought about this in preparation for our conversation today, I think my biggest failure was my capitulation to fear and not listening to my inner voice that told me not to commit the crime in the first place. That was my biggest failure.
Tell me more. Tell me how fear played into that.
So I'm going to go real quick through this. When I was putting together my fraud, so a couple of things were happening. My paychecks were shrinking. My lifestyle was expanding. I felt a great amount of pressure that I had to maintain it. And so I started thinking of ways that I could do that. And I knew that I could exploit our partner company's warranty policy for my financial gain. And so it took me about 4 months to put the fraud together. And when I sat at my dining room table before everybody was working from home, I'm sitting there and I've got my finger hovered over the mouse button, ready to hit send to initiate the fraud. And I couldn't put it down. I couldn't press the mouse button because my heart was saying, stop, don't do this. This is not the way for you. And so I lifted my finger off. I sat back in my chair. I thought about it a little bit. And I said, okay, I know this is wrong, what I'm about to do. What are the alternatives? The alternative was to be honest with myself and my wife at the time and say, I can't afford our lifestyle anymore. And I don't want to live this way anymore. And the thought of being seen as less than, because I never felt worthy of my relationship. I never felt adequate of my relationship. I didn't feel worthy of myself or adequate in my own skin. That was more frightening than committing fraud against one of the largest technology companies in the world. And so I started thinking about it and the finger started going back down. And I'm going to be honest, I felt like I found a treasure map that nobody else knew about and I hit send, but that's what started it. That was my failure, was my capitulation to fear.
So just to give the broad strokes of the fraud, where were you working and what was the actual fraud?
So I was working for an extremely large technology firm, and one of our partners was another tech giant, Cisco Systems. And I knew how to manipulate their service contract policy for my financial gain. So really quickly, I knew how to have Cisco send me brand new pieces of equipment, and I could send them bogus pieces of equipment back to keep the equation whole. Because if Cisco's sending something new to replace a broken product, they want the broken product back. So I figured a way to do that and then figured out a way to make money doing that. So that was really the quick overview.
Just because I love a scam. Where were you getting the broken product?
I figured out that I could buy them. It wasn't even broken. They were just used. And I knew that I could sell a brand new piece of equipment for more than I could buy a used piece of equipment. I got them off of eBay. There are a bunch of different marketplaces. So I would just do the math and say, okay, if I get part number ABC coming in, it's brand new, I'd find a buyer who was willing to give me $2,000. I knew I could go to eBay and buy one for $500. There's a $1,500 profit margin.
That's a lot of work.
So to give you an idea, and talking about like when I say my failure was capitulation to fear, I want to put a little context behind that. When I was arrested and I'm sitting handcuffed in the back of the car and the FBI, I didn't invoke my right to silence right away. And by the way, everybody always do that. But I was chatting with them and he said, who else is involved? I said, nobody. He goes, bullshit. Because we know that there's somebody else involved with this. We think there's a team of 30 people because there's no way one individual could do all of this by themselves. And so again, that like, it was easier to do all of this than to just have an honest conversation. It was a tremendous amount of work. So I have a hard time watching Goodfellas, you know, the end of the movie when Ray Liotta's coked out of his mind and the babysitter forgot a lucky hat and all of those things are going on. I have a hard time watching that because the energy in that scene hits the part of me that was committing the fraud.
I have a hard time watching that scene because the energy in that scene reminds me of my drug days. But without the fraud, I couldn't accomplish so much. So how long were you doing it and how much had you embezzled?
I did it for about 10 and a half months. The FBI was, the victim was onto me in about 6 months. And then the FBI used the remaining 4.5 months to basically give me enough rope to hang myself. So it was 10 and a half months all told. So this is going to be really interesting. All told, my restitution order, the amount that I owe, is $834,000. That's not the amount I profited. I committed career suicide, almost personal suicide, for $129,000.
Oh my God. If you had this high-flying lifestyle, that really probably just made a tiny dent in it. Well, over 10 months, that's a significant amount of money, actually.
It was pretty good. I mean, I'll never forget there was, you know, when I was at sentencing and the prosecutor's going through and 1 month alone, Mr. Stalin profited $29,000. And the only voice, the only gasp that I hear is my mom behind me in this dead silent courtroom. $29,000.
As I recall, you really kind of knew this moment was coming. Am I making that up?
There were so many red flags that I ignored. And again, it was just that capitulation to fear all the way through. There were so many red flags. I did know it was coming. Truth be told, when I first initiated it, I knew what I was doing was wrong, but I thought it was going to be between me and the victim. Like it would be just a financial settlement between. I didn't know what mail fraud was. I didn't know what wire fraud. I didn't know any of these things. I just knew it was morally and ethically wrong, but I didn't know I was breaking the law until I hit a certain finite. When I added up the total, I was actually did it in my head. I'm pulling clothes out of the dryer and I go, holy cow, list price wise, I broke the $1 million mark. And that's when it just, my heart just like clenched up. And then I knew I was doing something really wrong.
The victim was Cisco.
Correct.
Okay. Correct. And so I'm sure you were justifying that with, oh, well, you know, what are they going to miss? They got billions or whatever.
You know, I never really justified it that way. How I actually justified it, and I do this in my keynotes because I present to a lot of fraud organizations and audit organizations. The way I rationalize it was, Cisco sends a brand new piece of equipment. They expect a piece of equipment back. I was holding up my end of the bargain. I was sending them stuff back. However, I was ignoring the fact that I was using fake company names, aliases. I received over 600 components from them in 10 and a half months. I mean, this thing was like massive. I ignored all of that. And it bears noting that I've also figured out a way to increase my profit margin. I bought third-party equipment, which is basically like knockoff Louis Vuitton bags. You can get actually knockoff Cisco equipment.
Right.
So I was sending them trash. Didn't have serial numbers, didn't have a brand on it, nothing. I was sending them complete trash, but that was my rationalization. I'm like, they sent me one, I send them one back. We're even, Steven.
Right. So you get locked up for how long?
I got a 24-month sentence. I ended up doing 21 months total because I got some time off for good time. That was 15 months in prison, 6 months in the halfway house, Brooklyn halfway house. And the time at the Brooklyn halfway house was actually 4 months of living there and then 2 months on home confinement with an ankle bracelet. So I had to report to the halfway house once a week.
At what point would you say this turned to success?
That has been about a decade in the making.
Yeah.
So I think for me, there's just been so many different pivotal epiphany moments where they're just all these little incremental successes along the way. One of them was where I realized that I had worth and value outside of all the things that I thought made me worthy and gave me value. I wasn't my lifestyle. I wasn't my things. I wasn't all that stuff. I was just me.
Right.
And you know, that was enough. That was a success. Then when I started writing the book and realizing that I could help somebody with my story, that was a success. You know, I just wrote about this the other day, so I'm going to share it because it's fresh in my memory. I joined Toastmasters to conquer my fear of public speaking because I realized I made fear-based choices and that landed me in prison. So I had to conquer my fears. Number one fear, public speaking. Joined Toastmasters. My first talk for them was the icebreaker. And I went up in front of this group of strangers and I told them that I was arrested by the FBI, that I lost everything, that I was planning on how I was going to take my life. And jaws were just agape. I mean, as you could probably imagine, because not too many people go into a Toastmasters meeting and share that right off the bat.
Right.
And I just hit the home run. And this gentleman comes up to me afterwards and he goes, I've never seen somebody present with such raw, naked vulnerability. He goes, do you know, 20 years ago, I was addicted to crack. I was living on the streets and I was eating trash out of garbage cans to sustain my life. He goes, until somebody found me and took care of me. He goes, now I work here. And he pointed to the building we were in. I make over six figures. He goes, I've never shared that story. And he goes, you've inspired me to start talking about that story on stage. That's a success.
Right. And there he is in Toastmasters talking about whatever lesson he learned from the barista or whatever. That's fascinating.
It was all like the stuff he was reading out of personal development books and podcasts. He was sharing that and kind of like regurgitating it. And his talks took off when he started talking about his own experience.
Wow. So, which does lead to my premise, which is that entrepreneurs today, it's not true for all. Let's just say for most, it's imperative that they share their story. And do you agree with me on that?
I agree 100%. I agree 100% because I think in today's day and age with social media, where it's all about outward success that's being projected, the Lamborghinis, the Rolexes, the vacations, all of these things, we are inundated with everybody's success. But behind that, A, that might be a bunch of bullshit. And B, what was the journey to get there? What are the fears you had to face, the self-doubts? How many times did you fall on your face and get up? For me personally, that's where I connect with somebody. I want to know that you fell on your face. By the way, I mean, one of the things I love about you is your vulnerability with your past and your story and your willingness to share, because that's how we have impact.
For me, it was a very organic thing. I didn't realize you weren't supposed to do it until after I was already doing it. But have you seen entrepreneurs out there who are examples of this, who you admire for sharing their stories and you've seen their businesses grow?
One right off the bat, James Altucher. You and I have chatted about him in the past. I think James is the epitome of that. He shares his failures so openly. I mean, he is just like an open wound and has no qualms in doing that. And he's achieved tremendous success many times. Seems to be on an upwards trend right now, but, and I hope it stays that way for him. But that to me is really the epitome of sharing the raw and real story.
He seems to have stopped sharing so much, but it's interesting as he became sort of huge, he was constantly sharing. But now I feel like he's gone a little more dark. Maybe I've just lost it.
You're right. It has slowed down a little bit, but it still comes up. And I've also heard him say that he feels sometimes, I think, tired of sharing it.
Yeah.
You know, kind of onto like the new thing. And I can understand that.
Yeah. So when did you decide that this was going to be your mission? Was it at Toastmasters that day?
This was going to be my mission actually inside prison when I was writing Blank Canvas. I was sitting there and I'm writing about, I'm using one of those black and white composition notebooks, you know, that I bought off of commissary that I still journal with to this day, kind of my own little institutionalization of prison. But I'm writing in that, writing about getting divorced. I'm writing about getting arrested by the FBI, being financially ruined, like all of these things that happened only a couple of months ago. So it was like pouring bleach on an open wound. I mean, it really was painful to try to relive this. And I remember I was in the library and I threw my pen. I go, why the hell am I doing this? This is idiotic. I'm in prison. Why am I torturing myself like this? And my heart, The one that said, stop, don't do this. This is not the way. It spoke again and spoke really crystally clear. And I had to turn the page to a blank page to capture it and said, you're doing this to help one person. And that was, here I am at my rock bottom with nothing to my name. And I realized that my story could help somebody who feels right now how I feel. That was when I really realized that was my mission. That gets me up to this day. That happened years ago. And that is why I get up to this day. It's why I do the talks I do. It's why I write the books I write. It's why I coach, is to help one person.
And who is the person you envision helping? Somebody who felt how you felt, but is it men that are a certain age who are sort of materially focused?
Nailed it. And I'm just going to add a little bit of color to that. It is men ages 35 to 55 who have climbed to the top of their professional ladder, did all the things that they thought they were supposed to do. They checked all the boxes. They got the BMWs, they got the fancy watches, all of those things, except for purpose, meaning, and fulfillment. They are existing, but they are not living. And they feel the pressure of time as you realize that your mortality is kind of coming into light. I'm 50 and I certainly feel that. I know I'm on the back nine of my life. And the people who are feeling that, my ideal client, they want to write their remarkable life story in their second half.
Literally, they want to.
Some of them want to write, but I mean, I have somebody who loves Japanese woodworking, which is actually quite fascinating. He's a professional IT guy. He's got a great career, but it doesn't give him what he wants. And so we're working on him creating this thing with Japanese woodworking because it makes him feel good inside.
And so what is it, would you say you offer is primarily one-on-one coaching, or does the speaking and the writing sort of fuel that?
You know, I've gotten myself into a really awesome place where to me, they are all interchangeable. They're all interwoven. It's all the same message. It makes my day easier and it gives me purpose, meaning, and fulfillment. So speaking is a huge part of it. Working on the second book now, I mean, I do 2 hours every morning writing. I've done that for years. And then the coaching. And the coaching, quite honestly, is a little bit of a smaller aspect of it because I will only work with about a handful of clients at a time because I want to give them the focus that they deserve.
And it's always men.
Okay. So here's what's really funny. We just kind of ironed out, you know, in a sense, my ideal client, you know, 35 to 55, professional, male, all those things. I work with a 23-year-old female who just doesn't know what the heck to do with her life.
How do people find you?
They find me either through the book, through the TED Talk, through my website, craigstanlin.com. I'm on LinkedIn every day posting what I hope is adding value to people's lives. And all, interestingly enough, I write for the Good Men Project. I've written for James Altucher for his newsletter. All of those things. People find me in just really different ways.
And are there people who say to you, why would I ever take advice from you? Look at what you've done and try to shame you?
This is a really powerful and interesting question. So my people would never say that at all. And anybody who does isn't going to really reach out to me. And I think what's so important about that, what I've discovered, anybody who wants to say that, who wants to project that on me, I believe that is self-hate projected outwards. And that is just a window into their soul. And to me, somebody who would be willing to say that is they don't realize it. They think that their anger and their vitriol is them being empowering for themselves. It is actually an opportunity for me to express empathy because of the hatred that they have to live with in their own heart. That's what I believe.
And so what would your dream legacy be? Or you're gone and people are talking about you. What are they saying?
Craig lived a life true to himself. That would be it.
Are there any other failures that you wanted to touch on? I mean, you got such a nice big one that, you know, it's a pretty linear path from failing.
You go down, you can come up.
You go up. But is there anything else that comes to mind?
I will share one. So when I was in my early 20s, I was a personal trainer and I loved that job. It had the purpose. It had the meaning. It had the fulfillment. I made a really good living too. It was at a time where gyms were actually paying a higher percentage trainers as opposed to now they're really not paying them that well. And I had my own business. I went to people's homes in Westchester County and Greenwich, Connecticut. Mm-hmm. So I had clients that were way up there. I mean, literally one of my clients lived next door to a $150 million home. Mm-hmm. So it was a nice neighborhood to say the least. based. Mm-hmm. Loved that job, thought it was amazing. And I had this opportunity to enter the corporate world. And it was a huge pay cut. It was over a 50% pay cut to start at the bottom of the company, but it was a 401k, which in my 20s, I didn't know exactly what the heck that was, but I knew it was real important.
Yeah.
It was health insurance. Again, did something I didn't care, but you're supposed to have that. It was all the things that you should do because it was training. Is that a real job? Can you retire off of that? You know, really, you should buckle down, all of those things. And I capitulated and I took the job and I gave up on something that I really loved. And to me, that was a failure because I didn't listen to myself and stick with what I really liked and what I loved actually doing.
So as we wrap up, what are your top tips for bouncing back from failure?
Number one is going to be establish and embody your core values. I cannot express this enough. First, you have to establish them. You've got to get crystal clear. And oftentimes when I talk to clients, what are your core values? And they'll repeat them. They'll say them out loud. 90% of the time, they don't know them. But the ones who do, they say them. And I have to ask, I go, are those yours? Or did you get them from somebody else? And 100% of the time, they got them from somebody else. Wow. They think they sound good.
Right.
You have to establish those and you have to establish your own. Then you have to embody them. This isn't just coming up with a list of five and saying, these are my values. You need to be able to recite them like they were your name. And you need to run every decision and choice through those. And a couple of ways I do that really quickly is playing games with them. I have my clients, I do this for myself and I have my clients do this. Word association. You take your value, it might be freedom. That's one of mine. Freedom. Three words, the first three words that come to mind, write them down. Do this every day for a month. Fill in the blanks. When I embody the core value of freedom, it enables me to blank in my life. Do that every day so that it becomes an innate part of you. Mm-hmm. That's the critical component of that. So that is number one. You look like you might've had a question.
No, I'm loving this. I'm wondering, actually what I was thinking was, I wonder if he has this as a lead magnet on his website where you give this for people to fill out, because you should.
I'm going to make a note of that and do that when we hang up. We're done. I'm like, that's a great idea. Another tip is to get crystal clear on what you actually want in your life. When I do this with clients, I don't want to work a 9-to-5. I don't want to be working here until I'm 70. I don't want to be doing this. That's great. You didn't answer my question. You're telling me everything you don't want. What do you actually want? I don't know. Okay, let's get clear on that. So getting clarity on that. Now, step two on this step is the trajectory you're on and the choices that you're making leading you to that destination. If they're not, there's some work to do. If they are, awesome.
I love that. And so if you fail, rather than looking at it as the end, look at it as an opportunity to embrace this new process, kind of.
To embrace this new process. And number three is going right into that. You fail. It sucks. You fall down. You know, I mean, we all do. Every single thing, I believe, every single thing that happens in life has a lesson embedded in it. What is the lesson that we can learn from this failure? I think it's beyond don't do this thing that way. It goes into the deeper, why did I do this thing this way? What was I hoping to achieve? What did that achievement mean to me? But doing the deep inner work to understand the genesis of that failure, if you will, what was behind it, because it's an opportunity to connect deeply with ourselves. And when we connect deeply with ourselves, we tie to those core values and we get a little more clear on what we want in life. So yeah. I think those three are very interwoven.
I love it. In the same way that you can immediately say it was fear of this lifestyle that I was having trouble keeping up, that you go straight to what was underneath it, talking about the failure.
You go straight to what was underneath it. And then you can realize if there was a need that wasn't being met, is there a different, more empowering, in alignment with who you are and your core values, way to have that need met?
Right. And I think that that also reminds me of a good point. There's nothing wrong with valuing money. There was nothing wrong with you wanting to maintain a lifestyle. It was the way you chose to go about it.
It was. I love that you just brought that up. Nothing inherently wrong with money. Money's innate. The meaning we give to it, that's where we can get into trouble. My identity was rooted in it. My self-worth, my sense of adequacy, the feeling that I had to be wealthy to be accepted. That was what's wrong with it. But there is nothing inherently wrong with driving a $100,000 car and making $1 million a year. But if you need those things to be who you think you need to be, different story.
Agreed. Well, Craig, that is wonderful. Thank you. If people want to find out more about you, we mentioned it earlier, but give it to them now.
CraigStanlin.com. You can check me out on LinkedIn, and Blank Canvas, How I Reinvented My Life After Prison, is available on Amazon.
And his new book is going to be finished soon. He's been saying that for a minute. You told me that a while ago.
I did. I know. I knew. I was wondering if that was going to come up. Yeah. I got a little bit of scope creep going on it, but I'm narrowing it down and it's going to get done hopefully this year. And I have another fun project, a children's book, which is going to get done this year.
Love it. Well, thank you so much, Craig. And thanks y'all for listening.
Thanks for listening to Fail Your Way to Success. Now, if there's anything I love more than a failure to success story, it's a review. So I hope you'll think about leaving one. For more information about the show, go to failyourway.com. And for more information about publishing a book about how you failed your way to success, or just to find out more about what I do, go to legacylaunchpadpub.com.